How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here, Wrestling Observer Radio, January 21, 2016. FigureFourOnline.com/WrestlingObserver.com. Good old JR, the voice of New Japan on Access, we can say here, is our guest today. A lot of stuff to talk about. And Jim, what's going on?
Well, you kind of nailed some of it. I got kind of busy all of a sudden, so it's, things are good. I'm very happy, and main thing, I'm healthy, and it's good. Life's good.
Quite a trade-off where SmackDown got Mauro Ranallo, and then New Japan on Access didn't have Mauro, and so they got Jim Ross, and everything worked out best for everybody.
I hope so. I'm very happy for Mauro. You know, he got a kind of a bucket list dream job with WWE, and he's doing a swell job with it. He's a terrific announcer. I'm glad they're not yet. They haven't tried to change him, seemingly.
There's still time.
The trade was interesting. Somebody said to me on Twitter somewhere that was really a neat deal that the two companies traded announcers. I've been a while, so I said, yeah, they got me and a player to be named later.
That's right.
So now, when do you start? When's your first taping session, or do you know yet?
Yeah, I know. It's February 10 and 11.
Okay, so you're getting pretty. You know, what's kind of like? How did this come about? I mean, I think a lot of people don't know that. And what was kind of like your thoughts when they first approached you?
Well, my business manager, Barry Bloom, the infamous Barry Bloom, called me and said, I got an interesting call that Access TV is interested in you doing the play-by-play for the New Japan show. And I said, well, what about Mauro? And he said, well, it's kind of off the record, but he's going to WWE. I said, well, I won't say anything to anybody, but the bottom line is I'd be interested in that deal if you can make it a win-win. So Barry worked with Adam Swift, I think it was.
Yeah, probably.
And, nice guy. I said that right, didn't I, Dave?
What, that he's a nice guy? He's a nice guy.
Adam Swift, that's his name, right?
That's his name, yeah.
And he is a nice guy.
He's a hell of a nice guy. I know he's a big wrestling fan from the Carolinas. I like that. And he's a football and basketball fan. I like that. So we've had one conversation, and all that's conjecture last week, and this is done, that's done. Adam Swift and I had one conversation and have not had one since. Not that we won't, and we will. We have a lot of things to talk about. But so they approached Barry, and Barry contacted me to see if I was interested. I said yes, and so they began the dialogue. And I want to say this was in November.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah.
And I got into December, and then it seems like all the – if you're doing business with anybody and it's show business, broadcasting, whatever, and you try to get anything done in December, good luck. People are on there. There are holidays. There's Christmas. There's the Hanukkah. All kinds of holy days with the Jewish folks, and people are traveling and going to grandma's house. Blah blah blah. So nothing got done in December, and then in January, it heated back up again, and they got really into the negotiation and we worked out something that we both like, and so we're going to give it a shot. I'm very excited about the opportunity.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day. The New Japan shows on Access are quite a ways behind. I think they're mid 2015 now, Dave? About a year behind?
No. They're early 2015.
Early 2015. So it's about a year behind.
The last stuff I watched, I think, was around February 2015.
Okay, so about a year behind. And I was just thinking that Jim Ross here is going to be calling a whole bunch of Shinsuke Nakamura matches and AJ Styles matches.
And Gallows and Anderson as well.
That's right. At a time when those guys are going to be on the WWE main roster, at least likely Nakamura and AJ. AJ maybe even this weekend. And it's going to be something else to see those guys on Raw with that Raw announce team calling their matches and then being able to go to New Japan on Access and see Jim Ross calling those matches. This could be shocking.
I don't know. You know, we'll know. I appreciate that. I think I appreciate it.
You'll appreciate it more in a few months.
Style, you know, that's what it is. But we'll do like everybody else, like in the old days of the promotion. We'll just bury the talent. That's what we do.
Yes. I want you and Josh Barnett to bicker.
Entertaining or taking the high road, just bury their ass. That's all you do. You know, I'm kidding, obviously, but I don't know how they're going to have me handle that. And that, you know, there's Adam works very closely with the New Japan and TV Asahi, and so, you know, they'll if they have a instructions on how they want that presented, then they'll tell me, and that's what I'll do. And if not, I will ignore their WWE business. I don't know how you bring it into play without it cannibalizing the conversation, and then all of a sudden I'm talking about stuff that you aren't seeing. I'm doing what I don't like. I'm not talking about Twitter trending and all this other stuff. I want to call the matches and get talent over and bring you into this 1 hour of your day. So, but I'll follow instructions and however they want it done is what we'll do. And, but if they don't tell me, I'll probably just leave it alone. I don't know what you guys think about it, but I don't know how you bring it up and not, how do you bring it up, address it, and close it? Because every week you got to do it. Because you assume that somebody did watch last week. So AJ Styles on another match. So you have to do the same song and dance that week again. So I think it's best just to leave it alone. But maybe I'm wrong, and maybe somebody's got a better idea.
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting, and I just actually thought of it, is that like you were, of course, there at the Tokyo Dome a year ago, and you're essentially going to be picking up, I guess, now, what was your first show, the Fukuoka? So you're picking up actually about 5 months after you were there, but it's still, you know, a lot of the same guys that you saw, you know, I mean, most of the same guys that you saw when you were there are going to be the main event guys throughout the next first 7 months plus that you're broadcasting, and you're going to be doing the G1 tournament for this year, which had some phenomenal matches and
right.
Some of the Sumo Hall shows and the Super Juniors. I mean, I kind of was looking at the stuff. I mean, there's, you know, when it comes to like the matches that placed really high in Match of the Year, you're actually going to be doing voiceovers on a bunch of them in your first couple months there.
And you know, the nice thing about that is, and it's a little bit cheating, I guess, for an old purist like me, but I'm going to take the advantage, is I get all that stuff emailed to me. So I get to watch the shows before we go voice them over. And so if I do so the world knows now, the genie's out of the bottle. If I suck, I got nothing to blame but me. So I get to watch the shows. I get to, hopefully they're going to provide me with, which I think they do, really good announcer notes. I mean, they actually do this like a real network. So consequently, I'm very excited about that because I like to prepare. And it's, you know, and I'm not totally foreign to the product, obviously, but I'm not nearly where I'm going to be.
Now, let me ask you about that, because you did live television forever, and many times when we've had announcers on this show, one of the questions is, do you prefer to know the outcome or not? Does it make it harder or easier to know what's going to happen when you're doing a call? Now, this, you're not only going to know the outcome, but you will have watched the entire match in advance. Have you done that often in your career? I guess that's the first question. Will this be the first time you've done that, or how often have you had a chance to do that in advance?
He would have actually done stuff. But go ahead, yeah.
Brian, I've done, without sounding like a turd, hundreds of hours of what you're describing.
Sure.
Because, and it started all the way back when we did Power Pro Wrestling. Now, a lot of people may not remember Power Pro Wrestling. Certainly Dave will. And Brian, I know you're probably aware of it. But it was our secondary show of, you know, the UWS show, then the Power Pro Wrestling show was our secondary clearance. But we used, we revoiced matches, and we took matches that were shot on a handheld at the house shows and things like that and put on there, angles. So I did that all the way back in, 30 years ago, started that deal. That was in the 80s. And then when I went to WCW, we would do WCW New York, WCW Chicago, there's one more we did, and then we did a fourth one, like a generic one. It might have been an international show. So that would mean that on that syndicated show, I would voice those matches over generally 4 or 5 shows a day for that week. So that was every week. That was just routine. And I remember talking to Keith Mitchell, who's still doing some stuff with TNA, who's a WCW head of production. And we were counting up because it was a really busy week, and I saw him on Friday, and I was beat. My throat was hoarse. And he said, "How many matches did you do this week?" I said, "I don't have a damn clue, man, but a lot." And he looked them up, and I think I did like 90-something matches that week.
Ooh.
It was ridiculous. But anyhow,
but my question,
a lot of that, and I don't have any problem doing it.
Sure. It's not so much have you done taped matches, but when you were doing all of those, I mean, did you watch the whole show and then go back and voice over?
No, I was there when it was taped.
Okay.
I already knew what was going on. And then, but when I did the WCW New York or WCW Chicago or WCW wherever the hell it was, I would do all those in back to back to back to back. So by the end of the day, I've seen this match now 4 or 5 times today. And so you just have to regenerate your energy and not shortchange that viewer that's watching that show. It's just a matter of being professional and having a little bit of natural passion, I think. Maybe, or drink a lot of coffee. Hell, I don't know.
Well, do you find that it's easier after you've seen the match to generate the excitement again because you know when you're going to need to ebb and flow? Or is it easier when you're doing it live and this is the first time you've seen it?
They're two different mindsets and two different rushes, to be honest with you. In a perfect world, I'd rather do live TV and not know the finishes. Okay, that's my mission statement. I'd rather do live TV and not know the finishes. However, if we're going to do a voiceover post-produced audio track, then I don't have any issues with seeing the material, reviewing it. Now, when I say I want to watch the matches, just so you'll understand, I want to scout through the matches. I'm not going to watch every second of every match to preview it. I'm going to get a feel for what we're seeing. And if something pops out it flips a switch that I need to know more about this move or I need to know more about something, then I can adequately prepare for that. I'm not going to watch every match frame by frame. But in a perfect world, I'd rather just do live and do it, not know nothing, double negative, not know anything. And or if I'm going to do the voiceovers, I don't have a problem reviewing it because I'll do a better job for you. And you're not going to know, other than you know, but it's not going to sound like we're anywhere else but at the event on as far as passion and timeliness with Josh and my voiceovers, I don't think. That'll be our goal, is to make it sound like we're there.
What's your thoughts as far as Josh Barnett?
Good guy. You know, I've known him for years off and on. I think I met him through Davey Boy Smith, Harry Smith. I can't get used to that, Davey Boy Smith Jr. I'm not an advocate of the junior stuff. But in any event, I think Harry introduced him to me and some other guys in WWE. I don't know if it was something in L.A., I don't know what it was. If it was a SummerSlam or something else, or just Raw. I don't really know. Can't remember. But he was very, very learned, and I always admired his fact that he worked with Billy Robinson. I know that I was somewhat incredulous to read about his first ever pro wrestling match was in the main event of the Tokyo Dome.
That's right. That's amazing if you think about it now.
Hell yeah! It's like. So your first match is going to be, it's like bringing that kid that's got all the heat on him at NXT, allegedly.
Josh.
Yeah. I don't think it's first. Well, it may be, actually.
Yeah,
the Royal Rumble.
Working on top at WrestleMania, you know, it's not that far-fetched. But he did it, and I, you know, I like his MMA work. You know, I enjoy his fight game. And we've talked a couple times since I signed. And I only signed Sunday night. As a matter of fact, we haven't talked any since I signed. I talked to him twice before I signed. But he called and wanted to know, well, I guess you got the deal because he heard that podcast, I guess, that Kevin Sullivan and who's the other guy?
Mr. St. Laurent, MSL.
Yeah, Mr. St. Laurent. So, you know, they just jumped the gun a little bit. This wasn't a done deal. So, no big deal. I didn't care. So, he and I got on the same page. I think we're going to do fine. And I don't expect us to do a rehearsal show. I will if they want to do one, or if he wants to do one. I'll do whatever they want. I'm fine with that. Won't hurt me. Practice. Try to get better. But we don't plan on right now doing any walkthrough. Now they may say let's do a half a show, okay, or whatever. I think it'll be fine. I like him. I like personally enjoy talking to him. We got a lot of common interests, so I think it'll be good. I think it'll be good. I think he's really gonna. It's a good for him because I'm different than Mauro. Not better. I'm just different. But the more different people you can work with, the better your broadcasting skills generally evolve to.
Let me ask you a question about that, because Mauro Ranallo is now doing SmackDown, and overnight, Jerry Lawler has been rejuvenated. And obviously, I mean, the simple answer is, if your broadcast partner is great, you're going to do a lot better. But as the main announcer, I mean, Josh Barnett's already done a very, very good job with Mauro Ranallo, but let's just say that you had some random guy coming in that you'd never met before. What are some of the things that help you do a better job in terms of the performance of the guy that's helping you out?
Well, we have to spend some time together before we go live with this voiceover. You got to get a feel for the guy's cadence and how he talks, his pattern, performance pattern. So you can, there's a big thing about being a good announcer, in my view, is how good you are as a listener, because you really have to listen to your partner, among all the other things, all the other audio you have to process, a producer in your ear or two producers in your ear, and pyro and music and crowd noise and the ambient sounds, all that stuff. Your brain gets a lot of audio, but you really got to keep your partner's audio front and center. So that you got to listen, you got to get to know each other a little bit. If I was going to do something with somebody that had never heard their work, or somebody new that was they're going to try out in this role instead of Josh, for example, I would probably insist on going out there a day early and spending a day, maybe doing two or three shows with the new person, so that when we did them for real, that we had a run through. I just don't think that Josh and I are going to need a run through, but we might. You know, if they want to do it, we will. I think it's a matter of communicating, and then you got to judge their level of product knowledge, not just the specifics of New Japan. And oh yeah, they were created. They were formed in 1972 by Antonio Inoki. Blah blah blah. All the historic stuff. But you know, how much do you understand the why a hold works, or why they're using this hold, or the strategy behind this game plan? Or is this guy eating two or three punches to get his one in? What is the deal? So you got to have that guy that can filter all that out too. So it's a matter of communicating, Brian. You got to spend some time with him. Josh, I've met several times, and I talked to him on the phone. I've had him on my podcast. All these different communications, chances to talk, and so I don't think there's going to be any communication issue. The good thing is I'll be in L.A. a day early, so whatever we need to do, he and I, or the producers or anybody else, they'll be at that day to get that done. So we're planning on that, just to make sure. We're not going to put anything on the air that's not good. If we have to do it twice, it's not going to matter. We're going to get it right, and it'll be good. I'm really pumped up about this. I really, really, truly am. It's a chance to get back in the game, and I didn't like the way I left the game specifically, and look in the mirror on that deal, by and large. But I didn't like the way I walked away or got away, whatever, escaped, got let go. But now I got a chance to, kind of retie the bow and make it nice. And I think that's what we're going to do.
Well, over the last couple of years, I mean, there have been different flirtations from different people. I mean, was the fact that it's New Japan and that you went to the Tokyo Dome, I mean, did that influence your decision as far as taking this gig, or was it just access? Or what, because, I don't know if turned down gigs would be the right exact wording, but there have been you've had a lot of approaches from, and again, not just from wrestling, from between MMA and boxing. There's a lot of different people who you've been in contact with over the last couple of years. And this one is the first, real, what I would call full-time gig that you've taken since leaving WWE, as far as instead of just a one-shot here and a one-shot there.
Right. Yeah. We were never looking for a weekly gig. I didn't want to get back on that horse of traveling, saddling up and riding out Oklahoma every week. That just didn't appeal to me. And those that travel some get it. You know, but you know, I just deal with the travel like it is and the airline business as it is and hotels and, you know, I've never been this old before in my life. Only to be superseded by tomorrow, hopefully. So I just didn't want to get back on that horse of traveling all the time. So this opportunity, number one, I like the energy at Access TV. I like Adam Swift. I like the energy that Mark Cuban brings. I like his eccentricness, and his brilliance is good. That's going to be an interesting synergy. That means I would have worked for Ted Turner, Vince McMahon, and now Mark Cuban. If anybody else in the world can say that, I need to meet them. I'm sure there's somebody out there. But the New Japan thing was a deal maker, because I've had for years. I know that they're cool right now, and they're topical, and they're hot, and they're trendy, and hopefully they'll stay that way for years to come. I'll do my share. But, you know, they've been a viable brand since right before I got in the business. I got in the business in 74. So a lot of the guys, I remember the first time I went to Louisiana, I drove Danny Hodge from Tulsa to Shreveport for TV, and he had just gotten back that day, because I had to go wait on him, from Japan. Flown wherever he connected into Tulsa. Then when he got to Tulsa, right after that Japanese trip, I drove him 5 hours to TV. I refereed TV, and he worked. So he come back from working for Inoki. That's just the irony of that deal. My first road trip, my first day on the road, I'm driving Danny Hodge to Shreveport after a New Japan tour. So they've always been in my consciousness. And a lot of guys have, you know, always sung their praises, the whole Japanese culture. So the New Japan thing was a deal maker to me, and the fact that I could go out there and do a cluster of shows 8 to 10 times a year and get all my work done, it was very attractive.
When you went to Japan in January of last year, I mean, like, you know, I mean, you've been to Japan before. You went a couple times, I remember, with WCW for one of the Tokyo Domes with Flair and Fujinami. But yeah. Is there, you know, as far as being, like, around the New Japan people, you know, and all that, you know, what did you learn, and what was kind of your impressions of just being around and seeing that first Dome show, or the most recent, not the first Dome show you went to, but the most recent Dome show that you broadcasted?
Right. Wrestle Kingdom 59. It was a cool experience. I found out that more than not, at least the ones I've met in New Japan, talent, administration, so forth, the various officials, they seem to be very learned about the business in general, as far as the history of it and things of that nature. And I say that because I had wrestlers, and some of the wrestlers in their street clothes, I'll be honest with you, one in particular, I didn't recognize. And that's, you know, I had tunnel vision. I had an image of this person in their tights that I had committed to memory, because that's all I'd seen. And so when I met him in person, I was a little bit confused who it was, enough to not to say his name, until somebody introduced me to him, and I breathed a sigh of relief, and I was good to go. But I found out that they knew who I was, without sounding egocentric here, which proves my point that they studied the business. And I took selfies and signed stuff and did all kinds of neat things to show their talent. And I'm talking about Tanahashi and Okada, Nakamura. Three of those big stars all came to meet me and wanted pictures and so forth. So it was neat. It was really neat. And they were very respectful. And I could tell that the business to them was still very, very special. That the rite of passage and the honor of being in the wrestling business, which somebody could roll their eyes at, this, if you just compare it to today's product or to today's generation. And I can understand that. Don't agree with it, but I can understand it. But they still have that old school, they have great pride that they're, that's, this is what they do for a living. And I found that to be very refreshing.
I've been watching a lot of the older Raws, and obviously all the way up through today. And you've been there forever, on and off. And what are some of the changes that Vince McMahon requested in how his announcers did commentary over the years?
Well, I think that that memo that got leaked out here, what, last year sometime?
Oh, the one from like 2010, 2011?
Yeah. I saw it again late. I mean, somebody, because somebody asked me about it. I remember getting a document along, I don't know if it's that one, but a document, you know, of things that he has buzzwords and phrases he didn't like to use. And, you know, he didn't like to use, hey, well, it's going to be a war here tonight. Wars are out, gone. No war. Things like that. He obviously is he's a proponent of you being a storyteller, which means that to that group and the in the 203 area code means you can't do play-by-play, even though it shouldn't mean that. If you're really good and left unfettered, you can do compelling play-by-play in story form. It's a matter of connecting the dots and listening to your partner and bringing everything together based on what you're seeing on your monitor and not what you're hearing on your headset. So, you know... I think he's, there's certain things he's changed. I think he's got lax on some things too. He used to really be particular of what to do in the ring, and now you see a lot of duplicity throughout a 3-hour show, and maybe that's just the way that it is. I don't really believe that, but you don't need multiple same finishes. Schoolboys, small packages.
Yeah, schoolboy after distraction, yeah.
Everyone's favorite.
Yeah. And I love the distractions when there's a run, an unannounced run-in with music. Think about that. It's embarrassingly dim-witted.
Makes a babyface look like an idiot. Seriously, you're distracted by music like an and you get pinned.
Well, how did the guy, who did they play the music? The mysterious music boy.
Well, you intimidate the music man, I guess.
It's not like you're at an old school baseball park and there's an organist in the down the right field foul line.
Yeah.
You're not. You don't have the music. In other words, you don't. It's just to me, it's just crazy. But anyway, that's like acknowledging the. You're either going to acknowledge the camera backstage or you're not. You can't You can't have one foot on each side of the fence. It makes you really look dumb.
Yeah.
When I, as a fan, point out your dumbness, I am now digressing from what you're telling me. I'm thinking of something else.
Actually, Dave, before you ask your question, let me just do one more following up on that. When you mentioned that Vince wants the announcers to tell stories, you watch those old Raws where Vince was a commentator, and he was very good at telling the stories because he wrote the stories, obviously, or he was the man. He knew where everything was going, and he did a great job. I watch these shows, and I just think, you know, this guy is doing a great job telling me what I need to know and preparing me for where everything is going. And that's awesome, except when you have a product where the storytelling is very lax and storylines start and stop and they change directions and Paige is now all of a sudden friends with Natalia. I mean, how can you expect your announcers to tell stories when there's no real story to tell that lasts any length of time for the most part?
That's challenging. It's obviously challenging. And what you find yourself doing as a broadcaster with any common sense and a modicum of talent, and they do have announcers that have common sense and talent without question, is that you're forced to do one thing, and that's to ignore. Just don't go there. I'll bring that up. So that's what you do, and then you start having gaps in your storytelling. There's blanks. There's interruptions in service. It's like that buffering, internet buffering commercial on television that's running now. It's you're always buffering, so it's not good. So I don't have an answer for you other than, you know, obviously I was a little defiant in how I announced, thinking that I knew better than others what I need to say or what I, how I need to present things. And that didn't do me a lot of favors long haul. So, you know, it's just, I can't answer you. I don't know the answer. If I knew the answer, I might still be there working. I don't know.
Just on a change of subject, you know, there's been, you were, you know, a lot of people realize that, that you were in a very unique position. Besides being an announcer, for years you were head of talent relations with WWE for year, you know, for a long time. You always had input to the talent. You had input into the creative at certain points. When the Royal Rumble's coming up this year, this weekend, actually, and the, one of the things that, that I, it just is so glaring, and I know that they did try this weekend, on Raw on Monday to really get Bray Wyatt over, especially on Monday, and also on tonight's SmackDown, they do the same thing. But they really got in a position, they got way too reliant on Seth Rollins, and then he went down. And they really, I know they tried with Sheamus, but the heel side, I mean, we're looking at this Royal Rumble, and honest to God, I think that the mentality of the fans is that Roman Reigns will win or Brock Lesnar will win, and I guess there's the surprise element of Triple H, so to speak. But I don't think that anyone even like takes anyone else seriously as a winner. And I mean, granted, you're never going to have a thing where people believe all 30 can win. But I really think like at Royal Rumble, you should have 8 or 9 guys where people debate. And I think that, you know, it's really interesting going into this because I can't remember a year where, I mean, a lot of times in the year, people know who's going to win. They really do. But there's still the idea of 3 or 4 or 5 guys can win. And I mean, we're really at 3, you know, in most people's eyes because number 4 would be Bray. And I really don't see Bray actually winning the title. So, you know, they let the heel side get awfully weak, or they relax on it, and then they built it around a guy who went down.
Yeah, that would be your probably the corporate side would answer you that. Well, we didn't plan on having 3 guys that were viable contenders, but we didn't expect to have Cena and Rollins and Daniel Bryan. We thought you might have him back or whatever. I'm role playing here. But, you know, that puts you up to, that's 3 more, 4 more guys. So now you're up to 7. And there's something to be said about the injury situation. In an ideal world, you want several horses in the race that might be able to win the Rumble match. And that's good booking and good building for the year. To me, the Royal Rumble is indicative of how well you have built your roster since WrestleMania. The lights went out at WrestleMania. So after the lights go out at WrestleMania, the meter starts running on how you're going to get everybody ready for the next WrestleMania, which means building something to the Royal Rumble. So really the Royal Rumble is very crucial on that success of WrestleMania. I just did a thing, I think it's still on there, foxsports.com, on my top 10 Royal Rumble memories. And so I go back and I think I worked 13 Royal Rumbles in my career there, and one on radio with Gorilla Monsoon, I think, in 94. Bucket list time for me, by the way. But anyway, I got refreshed on all this stuff again. I read about every Rumble I did to write this piece, and I come to find out that some of my more vibrant memories were Royal Rumbles that had amazing undercards. Amazing undercards. And so there's an issue there that has affected the perception of the Rumble event is that the undercards are not nearly as good or as hot or as topical or timely or talent-laden as they used to be. So then you come to the scenario that we all dread. It's a one-match show. You know, so that's what it is. There's all due respect to the other matches. And I know there are other matches. Ambrose and Owens, right?
Yeah. That's the strongest undercard match. Yeah.
Yep. And the Charlotte and Becky Lynch have a match. There's a tag title match, which means nothing, unfortunately. Good guys in it. Hey, I know their position to be heels, but I cannot make myself not like New Day in a sense of, are they obnoxious sometimes? Absolutely. But do they have heel heat? Are you kidding me?
No.
Really? So I just think that's the whole thing, that they haven't, you got some injuries, you haven't got guys ready, but that's the charge of everybody there. Get me a hell of a roster ready for the Royal Rumble. Because out of that, I'm going to go to WrestleMania with my card that I've got booked. So I don't know. I don't know how you fix it. You know, it's you just got to have better planning and better booking, better long-term planning, I think is one of the issues. And I'll tell you something. You know, I've gotten this business in 74. I swear to God that long-term planning has been the Achilles heel of every booker that I've ever worked for. They all had the same, the guys that come from the old school, the wrestling side of the business, their products of wrestling, for whatever reason, they cannot make themselves make plan long-term. And I don't know why. Long-term meaning at least, long-term is no more, it's got to be at least a year. So I don't see too many promotions planning a year out. New Japan might.
They have little things here and there. They certainly promote. I mean, you can certainly see every year what they do in July and August when you know, when it culminates in January, you can look back and go, oh, yeah, they had, you know, they had at least a lot of the key stuff in their minds in July that they were going to do in January, you know, and just that whole G1, which is in a weird way, the G1 is in its way similar to the Royal Rumble because it's the setup for the main event for the Tokyo Dome. You know, you have your champion and then you have your G1 winner and they're, you know, going to meet. And so you kind of know the main event, which it's an interesting concept because in, you know, the main event in mid-August for January. And there's an argument that it makes things from mid-August to January somewhat predictable. But then the other argument is that you've got a direction and they go in that direction. And, you know, if it doesn't work, they can vary it here and there. But, you know, yeah. They, you know, I guess it's that's the two. The flip side is it's, you know, you either go with it's kind of predictable because you tip your hand, or you've got this whole long story laid out that climaxes on the right day at the right time.
And it is kind of ironic because
I like that latter of the two options for me works better.
And wasn't it this year that
planning's important?
Wasn't it this year that Vince actually had a top of the card for WrestleMania months and months and months and months out, and then everybody got hurt?
Yeah, I mean, the injuries definitely did affect things this year, without a doubt. I mean, the Rollins one in particular, you know,
Rollins, Cena.
Yeah, you know, Cena was a big one, and Orton was a big one as well. Yeah. So that was, you know, whatever. You know, one thing also, so now in your position, talent relations, you work very closely with Vince. You work very closely with medical. It wasn't, I don't think you worked with, were you ever with Maroon or was Maroon later? He came long
later.
After you were gone. Yeah. So
later.
So
I think I met him somewhere after that. I think I met him through Bruno.
Yeah,
and, I can't think of the fella's name. I'm going to kill myself for that.
Oh, is it Marty Lazzaro?
Yeah.
Good. Got the name.
The late Marty Lazzaro.
Yeah.
And they were big Maroon boosters. But they live in Pittsburgh, and he's helped them medically. So, anyway, I think that's where I met him. So I don't know him. I don't know if I even recognize if I met him again, to be honest with you. But yeah, I worked with our medical. You know, he had to. I'm managing a talent roster. That means everything: their money, their health, their schedule. You know, their psyche. You know, good luck on that one, and the whole nine yards. So yeah, I worked on that. So is this a segue to a Daniel Bryan question?
This is
actually.
In fact, a segue to the Daniel Bryan question because it's one of those things where you know, I mean, right now. I think that, like, with Daniel Bryan, you know, to me, you know, what has come out, I mean, what's really come out is pretty much what it is. I think people know what it is, but it's like all these conspiracy theories that the doctor and Vince McMahon are conspiring for this reason and that reason. And, I mean, when you look at it, it's like, and it's you know, again, you know, it's an interesting situation because there are doctors that have cleared him and there's doctors who haven't. And the whole concussion thing is a science that's very much in progress. I mean, it's not like the people who think, well, you know what, he should be cleared. I can't go say that you're wrong. And I can't say that they're right. I don't know. And no one, you know, it's just a really, and again, Daniel Bryan himself being such a unique personality because honest to God, and that is one thing. a lot of the guys, I think, in the business would, in their own weird way, be thrilled if they were in his position. And what I say, when I say that, it's they don't have to go on the road and they're getting a check, and it's gonna and they're gonna get a check for a long, long time. I mean, it's not like they have anything. You know, he has no concerns or anything like that from a financial standpoint. Whereas in the old business, if you don't work, you're gonna rush back because, you know, that's how you got paid. So he's in a unique position. Good, but being a unique individual, he wants to work, and a lot of guys do. But I mean, he wants to work. He's an entertainer, a professional wrestler, and he can't. You know, his passion is being taken away from him, and perhaps for all the right reasons for himself. You know, for long term. But it's how do you kind of like, because you and I talked about this a couple months ago when I did your podcast, but. You know, kind of looking at this now with what you know now, I mean, what's kind of like your thoughts on the whole situation?
Well, it's obviously a tough situation to address because you're dealing with such a volatile and potentially volatile subject. And you're dealing with a really a human being's health and his long-term health, which is even scarier. You know, I was in charge of talent relations when Draws got hurt. You know, I was and I was in charge of talent relations when Owen Hart died, and when, you know, these things happen and that you don't plan for, and they're in-ring oriented or around the ring oriented or whatever. It's not an overdose. It's not a car crash. It's not a, you know, something wrestling oriented. And so you really have to evaluate, how do I address this thing? If your team doctor, who you've put great trust in, is telling you that this athlete isn't ready to go back and do his thing, then I think you either have to change doctors and heads of your medical department, or you have to listen to what he says. And my inclination, based on very little information on this matter, other than the more anybody listening, some of the people listening may know more about it than I do. But based on what I know, I would say I would be making the same decision until the team doctor, Maroons in this case, gives the clearance. Morally or ethically or whatever, I would feel really remiss to violate that trust for the doctor and give this guy open the door to get back in the ring when there's a question mark. And I don't want to be that guy that, you know, well I wish you stuck to your convictions because now look at him. And then if you go against your doctor and then something happens to Brian, God forbid, could he have heirs or family that could sue WWE, and could, you can, all everybody, well, wait, he could sign out a waiver. He could say, God, hello, pal, if you're going to start signing waivers to hold the company hold harmless on a paralysis, are you kidding me? We're talking this? So you want me to release you so that you get back in the ring, but you're going to sign this whole harmless agreement so that if you end up in a chair or worse, you won't sue me, or your heirs won't sue me. We're having this discussion to get back in wrestling. Hey, I admire your passion. We can't accommodate you. Until the doctors clear you, we can't accommodate you. Now, what would you like to do? You got this gig. We got plenty of plans for you. You're going to make a great living. You're going to be around the business. You're going to be able to get back to the business. You're going to be able to, he could be a great trainer, motivator. You know, he might be a good broadcaster. Who knows? The kid can do a lot of really good things to help the business. But even more than him getting back in the ring and putting his body at risk. So that's kind of where I am. I heard about the UCLA deal, and I'm not dissing the UCLA doctors or anybody else, but you took this one doctor to the dance, man, and that's your guy. It's a public deal. So you either need to, why would you go against his orders? And how would you do it legally and have a leg to stand on after that? I don't know. I don't know the answers to those questions, but I admire the fact that guy wants to work, and I really respect the fans that want to see him work, perform. But I think there's a much bigger picture here, unless people have walked in the shoes of some of us or been in the situations that we have unfortunately been in, it makes you think more deliberately and in a big picture sense, if what I said makes any sense.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask, kind of a follow-up on this, because you're obviously, everyone knows you're a super big football fan, pro football, college football even more. In the last, whatever it's been, 5, 7, 8 years, around football, you know, and you're friends with the Oklahoma coaches, the mentality about injuries, concussions in particular, within the football game, have you noticed like a big difference, and how has kind of the mentality changed when if that subject comes up? Because you know that's more than wrestling. That's a big part of football.
Oklahoma's a big time Division I football powerhouse. I think we could probably agree on. And whether you're a fan or not, I mean they won 7 national titles, and you know they sell out every game, 85,000 in a stadium. It's bigger than a lot of NFL stadiums, by the way. So it's a football powerhouse, and they are hypersensitive on concussions. It is a red-hot topic. And even the referees tell me that that's one of their, they call them points of emphasis, to be aware of concussed players. And so, in other words, if a guy gets a real big hit, keep your eye on the assaulted one, or on the assailant and the his victim. But you got that's a big issue. Absolutely, it's a big issue. So, and you only got to believe it's going to get bigger. I saw today on SportsCenter where Antoine Randall-L played quarterback at Indiana and played for the Steelers as a wide receiver. Is having he's working on his master's degree. He's away from football, but he's having issues with his concussion issues. But he's trying to stay ahead of the curve, but he's documenting all of his memory loss and forgetting to do this and that. So it's a big topical thing, man. And
didn't he say that if he had a chance to do it again, he would not play football?
Yes, sir. And he'd tell his sons to play golf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a really big hot button issue. Because, as Dave, as you pointed out earlier, the one sentence probably spoke more volumes than anything we've said, we don't know. It's an ongoing research, investigative, searching for information journey. And I don't want to be the guy that agrees to be a party to putting a young man who's not been married that long, has got his whole life to live, in harm's way, knowing that he has an existing condition. And so, and this says, well, I don't understand why he couldn't sign a release and do it, go and that way he wouldn't sue WWE. Think about what you just said. Are you living in your mother's basement? Are you pimply faced and stupid? Golly. Yeah, what are you going to do? What are you going to say when he's in that chair? Well, that won't happen. Really? How do you know that? Can you guarantee that? Well, no. Of course you can't. So that's where we are, man. I'd love to see the guy work. He'd be a great shot in the arm for them. Nobody's say it differently. But I just think until Maroon signs off on it and his staff, and they undergo more tests, where he's got to do with them, or they collaborate with the other doctors at UCLA and things of that nature. I am assuming that the report from the UCLA doctors will be provided Dr. Maroon, wouldn't you think?
I would think he's already seen it. This, but I would think logically that he has. I mean, but now here's the other thing, though, and this is what makes the situation even both more topical, but it makes it just another layer is the movie and Dr. Maroon as a, I don't know if you have you seen the movie, by the way?
Yep.
Okay. So Dr. Maroon is a character in this movie. So he's in a situation where if he makes the wrong call in that direction, let's just say let's just say, again, I mean, it's he's, I mean, you're looking, again, we're talking about a human element here, okay? It's like the referee situation, right? When a referee blows a call in one way, even though you're not supposed to, we all know that subconsciously they're going to go like, I blew that call. He might be more, you know, lenient towards that other direction because it's like balancing out. Like, I mean, and Brian, you and I have seen this in fights where if a guy stops a fight late on a show and he comes back and referees later and the heat's there and everyone knows it, he's stopping the next fight early.
I mean, oh, yeah.
I mean, he's not supposed to. He shouldn't. It's a panic response. But everyone here, we're all human and we all have human tendencies. So you've got this doctor who is in this movie portrayed in a certain way. Some would say very unfairly. I know the guy that Alec Baldwin played, Julian Bales, you know, who's another main character in that movie. He said that the character of Maroon was very much played unfairly. And he said that publicly. But he's in a tough position because he's the, you know, he's a villain in the movie for not caring about concussions. So he's got a portrayal to people who saw the movie. And if he were to clear the guy, I mean, unfortunately, you know, I don't know that this has anything to do with it. I don't, you know, like I say, like I'm throwing this out. But I also know from a human being standpoint that I would think if I'm in this situation, I'm under the gun and they're portraying me fairly or unfairly as a guy who's oblivious to concussions or, you know, cold-hearted and is only in for clearing these players to play in the game and things like that, that right now I'm going to be more cautious. So that adds another, you know, it's just another aspect of this thing.
Well, I'd like to think that Dr. Maroon is doing this for the simple reason that that's his best medical judgment.
I would like to believe that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that I saw a concussion, and Maroon wasn't played very favorably, but I didn't leave the movie thinking, oh my God, that Maroon guy. Oh man. You know, it didn't stick out to me that much that he was the, you know, I don't know. I didn't carry bad things, feeling about him leaving the film, other than I felt more negative about the NFL in general for turning their heads on some of this stuff. So, but anyway, that's another story for another time. But I just don't know. I think that with it's all ongoing. They're finding out more stuff on this CTE stuff every day. You know, gosh, I thought the movie did a real good job of shedding light on the issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah,
so it was, I think that was the main thing about it. I thought it did a hell of a job on that regard, but I don't know, man. I just wouldn't want to be. I'm glad I'm not in that chair anymore because I wouldn't want to be. I'm afraid I'd be hard to convince that. You know, hey, look, if Vince signs off on it, then it doesn't matter what the rest of us think at that point. But he would ask opinions, certainly mine on talent, and I would be very honest to tell you, I'd say no, I wouldn't do it. If there's a cloud in the sky that this kid could end up in a chair because of his existing ongoing condition. Because it's easy to say, look, when you get in the wrestling business, you know it's a calculated risk, and that's a chance that they all run. Of course you do. But you don't get in the wrestling business with existing condition as a rule, at least knowingly.
Well,
so there's an issue there, and it's not good for this kid and this young man. And his young wife and any young children they may have. So I'm probably not making a very popular statement here on this matter, guys, but I'm just telling you, I'm pretty damn honest about things, and that's just how I feel. And it's because I've had some real sleepless nights on issues like this.
You know, I mean, like in your career when you and Vince were working together and guys were hurt, and, you know, there's always, you know, I mean, this is a situation, and you may not have dealt with this because, again, the concussion thing we didn't know as much about concussions at all when you were running talent relations, but there were all kinds of, you know, you were dealing with guys with injuries on a constant basis. I mean, that's right. That was the nature of the job. And you were there when they had that plethora of the neck injuries. So it was like, you know, like, so, and that's, you know, it's under your watch and everything like that. You know, I mean, you kind of, at that point, you kind of go, like, we got to learn about this and we've got to figure out, you know, you don't want an epidemic of something and not, you know, learn from it, right? I mean, like, what was kind of going through like in that situation, you tried to make things, you tried to do things to make things safer. And, what kind of stuff, like what was that going through that period like?
Well, a lot of it was trial and error because you're dealing with things that you really weren't trained. I wasn't trained in neck injuries, obviously. So, and you want to learn more about that whole kettle of fish, and you want to also, maybe as important, find somebody to fix them. And we used Lloyd Youngblood in San Antonio with a lot of guys. I think he did Austin. I think he did Benoit, maybe Edge.
I think he did. Edge may have been Maroon. I'm not sure.
Might have been. Anyway, you got to find somebody to treat them. And, the other thing I did, and just listen to talent, you listen to your guys and gals. We got rid of those Hogan Bundy rings, like working on my floor here I'm looking at, my living room. So we got rings that are more bump friendly. I think that helped a little bit. You can tell guys not to do certain things. I think at one point, I think it was pared down, which is common sense anyway, where the only guy doing a tombstone was Undertaker. Because nowadays, hell, if somebody uses it for a high spot. So, but you just try to learn what caused the injury, how long have you had this injury, how long have you been in discomfort. You fact find and try to backtrack and work away at fix this or that. And you get them the best working conditions that you can. And if they have any issues with it, if they have discomfort, you encourage them to come to you right away so you can have it. You can get the MRI or a CAT scan or whatever you need. We never scrimped on funding for medical issues. That's one thing you can look at the WWE and say they do some things creatively that we all cringe at time to time, but they don't skimp on money like Dr. Andrews guys of the world. You know what I mean? You're getting good doctors and you're getting good care. At least there certainly was when I was there. We didn't have any issues with that I recall. You flesh out some bad doctors. Ones that like to really prescribe medicines.
Yeah.
So, and that's another issue that's a...
Yeah, you had issues with... I remember you had issues with certain doctors, and one of which
30
was...
30 doctors.
Yeah, Hackett. I remember that whole deal with Dr. Hackett, yeah.
And so you run across that, All I know, guys, is when I left that job, when I drive by one of those, I'm sure you got them all over the place, even up there in the great Northwest, these minor emergency clinics.
Oh, yeah.
So I looked at those as drug dealers. All they are is another drug dealer with a franchise. Down the street's another franchise. They sell chicken. Down the next block, they sell burgers. Here, they have meds.
Well, I will say one thing very quickly before we go. I sprained my back, and I went to one of those clinics, and this doctor was begging me to take all of these painkillers and muscle relaxers. I told him no, and he said, "Hey, I can get you." Blah 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 blah. I was like, "Wow." Yep.
That's the whole deal, man. That's a sad situation, but I think it was a unique time in that those necks, and we got a lot. I remember when I talked to Benoit one time, there was two surgeries you could have done. He could have done one surgery that was a temporary fix, going through the back of his neck, and there was another one going through the front that would be a permanent fix. But the one going through the front was a year off.
Right.
And I remember exactly where I was standing in Atlanta. When he and I had our talk about that. And I said, here's what I would do. I am encouraging you to do this. Take the year off, get the good surgery, get it fixed permanently, and you'll get your check every week. Well, I got a six, the contracts had a thing where if you couldn't perform your duties after 6 weeks or something, the company had the rights to, terminate it or whatever. It's pretty standard language as far as I understand. Anyway. I said, your job is safe. And I remember he gave me the stiffest, hardest, almost, the only other hug I got like that was from Rick Steiner one time years ago. and my back snapped like some of that cellophane stuff. But Ben, I remember exactly where it was. So Ben Wild, I didn't know about going to the front, going to the back, how long the recovery time is, all that stuff. So it was an interesting issue, an interesting time. But anyway, I got Brian's hint there. I got the office. We'll let you go. Hey, we're going to go to bed so you can go home and come back and see us when you can.
That's right. That's right. Hey, let's talk about your podcast.
You take time, if you can, to listen to my podcast with Lex Luger. It's on somewhere right now. Podcast One on iTunes. I was shocked at his honesty, his clarity, and his openness to talk about the issues he's had in his life, which are long and significant.
Oh, yeah.
He's very, very lucky to be alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talks about, and it's not a cry for help. He's not looking for money. He's not, you know, he just tells it like it is. And he's doing motivational speaking, so you can tell he's kind of got his rhythm. And he was very, very good. So it's my podcast this week. Check it out if you get time.
Podcast One and New Japan on Access. He's going to be, Jim will start taping here in about a month or so, and you'll start seeing those coming up. I believe they will debut in March. Is that right?
March 4th.
March 4th.
March 4th.
When you guys called me today, I was reading Lion's Pride.
Oh, yeah.
Really good book.
Chris Charlton.
Yes, it's a very good book.
I'm doing my homework. I want to. And I told somebody that on the interview the other day, the Access setup, we're coming to be the best broadcast team on television in wrestling. Just so everybody knows. That's all I'm going to say.
I know what you're thinking right now.
You set yourself up when you say that, but I know you got confidence
nowadays,
in your work.
Nowadays, this should not be too tough, Jim.
The thing about it, Brian, you young rascal, is if you're going to play the game, don't you want to be the best player?
Yeah.
So this is the only way I can see even approaching this opportunity. Why would you want to go, you're not saying this, but I'm not going to half-ass it, and we want to leave the, hey, at the end of the day, next year when they do that Wrestling Observer Announcer of the Year voting, maybe we get recognized. Maybe we get a vote or two.
I think you will do okay.
I got a vote or two, and I did one night.
Yes, that is right.
Well, you know,
all my mail got to San Jose, so.
Yeah. You know, the one thing about the New Japan, you know, we really haven't talked about it, we kind of brushed on it, was, you know, this is a style of stuff that you can sink your teeth into. I mean, as far as the style of wrestling that they do, you know, the physical style, some of the longer matches, especially when they have the championship matches, the championships mean something. The guys, as a general rule, are very technically sound. I mean, they're really kind of incredible in that sense, how well they're trained and conditioned and everything. I mean, it's like you're going to have opportunities to tell stories and call, you know, like we said earlier, some of the best matches of last year and going forward, next year and going forward. I mean, because these are exceptional wrestlers that you're going to be doing, especially when you're doing the main event shows.
Very lucky, man. That's right. That's another thing is that I think that, and we discussed this with everybody involved, is that I think my style of what I'm most comfortable doing will fit that product very well. At least I'll knock on wood. I'm going to go into the game thinking, or the process thinking that's where we are. So and I'm watching a lot of it, and, you know, I'm becoming now, I want to be a historian, and I want to relearn more. So, and I got so many guys I really appreciate, you know, the John Pollocks of the world and that have stepped up, and other guys, several other guys, as a matter of fact, to say, hey, you need any help? Let us know. And man, you don't think I'm not going to take them up on that? Heck yeah. I want more information. I want to be loaded for bear. So it should be good. I'm really, really excited about the opportunity. It's like I feel really, really young again. So, you know, I got to be careful. I don't fall and break a hip.
Yeah. Well, hey, just think, you know, like you've got a long way to go to catch up to Vin Scully.
That's exactly right. So let's start on the streak, right?
Yeah, I mean,
don't. I, The travel is so good that I'm not going to have any issues of, you know, just getting wore down. So I think it'll work out fine. I wasn't ready to be sitting on the porch yet, so I'm really happy for the opportunity. It's going to be fun.
Well, Jim Ross on the Jim Ross podcast at Podcast One and New Japan on Access starting in early March. And check it all out, everybody. And Jim, obviously, I want to thank you for doing the show today. I'll be on your show, it looks like, next week, so I'll talk to you
next
soon.
Week, we're going to talk Royal Rumble.
That's right.
Baby.
A Royal Rumble post show. Hope it's a good one. That's coming up next week. And that's it, everybody. We'll talk to you again after a while.